So welcome. Today's podcast is going to be the audio of an interview that I did with Jimmy Herring in late November of 2012 for All About Jazz. This was just about a year to the day after my feature interview with Jimmy for All About Jazz. Of course, in that one, it was a wide-ranging interview. This one, we focused primarily on his most recent CD, Subject to Change Without Notice. And in this particular case, it was a lot of fun because this is an extraordinary CD. Almost every song on this CD is very, very different. You can't really point out what it is. There's elements of Indian music, there's blues, there's kind of classic rock, gospel, funk, you name it. I mean, it's all over the place, and Jimmy is just absolutely amazing. And the recording quality, John Keane did it. He's worked with Widespread Panic and R.E.M., I believe, and a bunch of groups, but just great. And a very interesting array of musicians. He's got a bass player from Africa. He's got bluegrass players. He's got jazz players, Bill Evans, Nikki Sanders. It's just really, really a remarkably diverse CD. And of course, it's a lot of fun too because Jimmy's teenage son came in and did some cello on this CD on a couple of tracks, and Jimmy's daughter did the artwork for it. So I asked him about that, and that was a lot of fun to hear him talk about his kids. And as always, it was a lot of fun speaking with Jimmy Herring, and it's really exciting what he's putting out right now, and I think the future looks really bright for Jimmy as a solo artist, so enjoy. And by the way, if you like this interview, be sure to check out my website, Talking to Musicians. That's the number 2, talkingtomusicians.com. And there you can listen to other interviews online, you can download the MP3s of the interviews, or you can subscribe to the podcast. And there's links also to the print interviews that I've done, and some visual things there too that you might enjoy. As always, the music that you hear in the background, that's Matthias Bublatt. He's someone I've interviewed, a great young German musician, and I hope you'll check him out. So enjoy the podcast.
Last year, it was interesting. That was right around Thanksgiving. And when you described all your commitments for 2012, it just sounded like it would be impossible for you to be able to put something out this year. So when I saw that something was coming out, I thought, you know, that's a blessing when an artist has a management and a label like Suvik behind you, because I'm guessing he really went all out to make this happen.
Oh, man, he is the MVP of everything that he's involved in. You know, he doesn't understand, you know, the word no is not in his vocabulary, and he will do whatever it takes to make things happen. You know, I love that guy. You know, without him, this would never have happened, you know.
And it's great, you know. I think Derek has the same kind of thing with Blake. When you have somebody behind you taking care of business who gets your music and believes in your artistic vision like that, you know?
Absolutely, yeah. Blake's incredible. I've known Blake since, good Lord. I knew Blake when he was loading the truck and you know, driving the van from gig to gig for Derek, you know. So I've known him a long time.
Yeah. Yeah, so those two guys, you're both really fortunate, I think, in that respect.
We definitely are, definitely.
Well, another thing I wanted to mention to you, too, is what I thought was particularly striking is how wide-ranging and dissimilar the musical styles are on this album. And yet, it's so cohesive and it has this organic feel. That's what I was getting at before. I think that's what kind of makes the magic. You know, it's much more than just a collection of interesting tunes. And I'm curious, do you have that feeling too, that you achieved something special this time out?
Well, you know, I can't get too close. You know, when you're this close to it, sometimes it's kind of, you know, you know that you're hoping for something like that. But, you know, I just know this much. I know that John Keane is somebody I've wanted to work with for a long time. And, you know, I went in to talk to him. You know, he's a friend of mine, and I've worked with him before with Widespread Panic, but, you know, this album was going to be something completely different, and I had most of the music together, and, you know, I went into John, and I said, John, you ever co-produce records? You know, and he, you know, I didn't know if he would be up for co-producing, because he's done a lot of records on his own. And he said, yeah, man, I would be up for that. So but the longer I talked to him about it, the more I realized it's like, look, I don't want to co-produce this album. I want you to produce it, but I want the final say in my own performances. You know, like, you know how a lot of times, if you work with producers, you know that sometimes they make you keep stuff that you know that you can do better, you know, and sometimes they have to do that because the artist will drive them out of their mind trying to make things perfect, you know.
Right.
And so I had a deal with John. I said, look, John, I don't want any production credit on this album. I'm not a producer. You are a producer. I said, I want you to produce this record, but please let me have the final say about my own performances. And he said, sure, we can do that. And so he was very patient with me. And you know, he let me do things the way I wanted to do them. And, but at the same time, he produced the record and he was an invaluable, you know, catalyst in a lot of the performances on this record. And, you know, he helped me put things together. I bounced ideas off of him. Every time I would hit a wall, you know, during the making of the record, he had all kinds of great suggestions that helped me break out of the rut that I was facing. And, you know, I'd say I knew we had something fairly special because I know how good he is. And I know the other musicians on the project, I know how good they are, you know, and, you know, so I knew we had something, but, you know, I was a little worried that, you know, cause at one point he goes, wow, every song on this album is coming from a completely different place.
That's the beauty of it.
Well, you know, strangely, thank you, man. You know, strangely enough, it wasn't intentional to do that. It just happened that way. And, you know, when it came time to choose the order of the songs, I started looking at the songs and I wrote them all down on one piece of paper. And I looked at different ways of putting them in order. I did it one way by tempo, you know, like I didn't want to have two songs in a row that had the same tempo.
Right.
And I did it another way by style, you know, like I didn't want to have, you know, two funk tunes right next to each other or two jazz tunes right next to each other or two, you know, simple singer-songwriter type songs right beside each other. And actually, man, it ended up being about the same every time. You know, and so the order of the songs came about that way. You know, like it only took 5 minutes, you know, to decide what order the songs were going to come in.
It was like a natural fit.
Yeah, and just about any way that we chose to put the songs in just about any order we chose, that it still was jumping genres every time. And it wasn't intended, and it didn't even come to my attention until after we started to sequence the record. I was like, God, you know, every song's from a different place. And John didn't, you know, the producer, John Keane, he didn't think there was anything bad about that. You know, he pointed it out. And I was like, well, yeah, I guess you're right. Every song is completely like from another world. But, you know, that kind of, it's weird, and it was subconscious. It wasn't conscious, but it kind of sums up the way we look at music, you know, which is, you know, we don't look at music in terms of labels. You know, we just like all music, and it didn't seem important to have this be a rock record or a jazz record or a guitar record or a saxophone record or whatever. You know, we just like music that is, you know, music, and I guess that's kind of where this was coming from.
Well, you know what appealed to me about it, and I thought it was kind of an interesting thing, and from what you said, it's not the case, but I thought it was kind of fitting that you did a cover from Sgt. Pepper's, because that album for me was like the best example I could ever think of somebody taking all these kind of really wildly different musical variations, like The Benefit and Mr. Kite and Day in the Life and Within You and Without You. And
Yeah, you know, man.
Just think about every Sgt. Pepper's itself, the whole thing. It's just completely lovely. Rita, meet her maid, she's leaving home. I mean, it's just wild, just like your album. It's all over the place, but it has this totally organic feel. You can't imagine it being different, and it's so special, but, and you keep listening to it because of that, and that's what made it really click, and I thought, wow, that's got that same magic in it, and it's kind of fun to hear that it just sort of happened that way. And I thought to myself, too, another thing was kind of like they had George Martin in the background and you had John Keane, who's a producer and also a musician. And, you know,
yes.
and his parts with the pedal steel, you know, that coloring and the flavoring that he added to things, you know, like the Emerald Garden, you know, and several things. I mean, it's just beautiful what he did. And I just wondered acoustically and sonically, what did you learn from him? You know, working on that.
You know, well, one of the things I learned was just to trust him, you know, and, but, you know, I'd made a record with him before and I learned to trust him on that record, you know, and that's why I came back to him for this record, was because, a few years ago, Widespread Panic made a record with him and, you know, they've made several records with him and I was impressed with his style of production. And that's one thing I learned from, is to trust him. Like when he asked me to try something that I didn't know if I was capable of, I might, you know, normally would have gone, man, that's, you know, that's crazy. I'm not going to do that. But I've learned to trust him. And, like for instance, on the song Kaleidoscope Carousel, he wanted me to go into the room with the amp and, you know, do some long sustaining feedback notes, and he wanted me to ignore the harmony. He wanted me to, you know, like when the harmony moved, my tendency is to move with it. And, you know, cause you know, you spend a lot of time in your life developing as a musician, being able to, you know, make the changes and, you know, things like that. And, but he was like, well, Jimmy, just try ignoring the harmony. Like whenever the chords move, don't move with them. Just stay where you are. And I was like, ignore the harmony. I don't know if I can do that, John, but I'll try, you know. And he had a vision that I wasn't aware of. And so he had me do about 5 or 6 different guitar tracks where I was just holding long notes and not paying attention to the harmony, or trying not to anyway. And then I didn't know he was planning to play all 5 or 6 of them at the same time.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, I took a different approach on each one. And then I came back into the control room and he played all 6 of them at the same time. And I was like, whoa, it sounded like a bizarre symphony of guitars, you know. And I had every note of it was improvised and I had no notion what he was up to. And that's what the intro to Kaleidoscope Carousel, that's what that is.
Yeah, I was going to ask you, that's really uncanny. That's beautiful the way that worked.
Thanks,
man. And you know what else grabbed me about that song? Towards the end, it's really uncanny. You know, I know like Dwayne Allman supposedly wanted to try to get a slide sound out of his a blues harp sound out of his slide. That's what he was shooting for.
Right.
And towards the end of that song, there's a couple of things where you play something, it sounds like you are totally channeling Little Walter. I mean, that is just so much like a blues harp. It's just incredible. Was that something you were shooting for, or is that just a lucky?
Oh, man, well, thank you so much. But, well, in a way, I was shooting for that. I'd been experimenting with the tremolo arm on Stratocaster. And, you know, of course, Jeff Beck is the king of it, you know.
Right.
But I'd been experimenting with that for a while. And, you know, I'd found these things that kind of sound like slide guitar.
Right. I've seen you do some things where you showed how to do that. And I thought, well, you've taken it a step further this time because you've really achieved a blues harp.
Well, yeah, that's that twang bar, you know, that's the tremolo arm on the guitar can, you know, there's ways that you can, I started experimenting with it, you know, and like on the last record, I still didn't use, I'd never messed with one before. But about 2.5 or 3 years ago, I started experimenting with the twang bar on the guitar, and I found these little things that kind of sound like harmonica, and I began to just started creeping into my improvisations, you know, these little things that sounded kind of like slide guitar. Some of them sounded like harmonica, and every now and then, you know, you would hear something that sounded like bagpipes or, you know,
right.
That I mean, of course, like listening to Derek Trucks and knowing him for as long as I've known him, you know, some of his type of things would start creeping in there, and Dwayne Allman, obviously, and Elmore James and Little Walter and Snooky Pryor and some of these other great harmonica players, even Billy Gibbons, you know, the stuff he did on early ZZ Top records, you know, where he'd take a harmonica solo
right.
in a certain place. You know, these type of things just start creeping in, and I found these little things, and that seemed to be the best place to use it was at the end of that song, and that's what that is. You know, I just took, I don't know, I think I took two solos at the end of that song, and John Keane and I used pieces of both of them. You know, and.
Yeah, you nailed that one. I love that. And I wanted to mention, too, it's a similar kind of thing on Aberdeen. You've got a human voice quality on a couple of parts of that song. It's just wild. I really had to do a double take with my ears, you know. It sounded like a human voice. And I was going to ask you, am I reading too much into that, or were you shooting
for
that?
No, man. I mean, that's definitely, well, you know, in Aberdeen, like, all the melodic, you know, the melody sections of the song were done on a Telecaster. And, you know, I didn't have a twang bar on there. But the solo in that song that's in the middle, I used a Stratocaster with a twang bar on it. And, again, we're coming back to that slide guitar thing. You know, it's kind of, I was going for a gospel kind of a thing.
Exactly.
Like a gospel singer, you know, kind
exactly,
of like a gospel
Jimmy.
Singer.
You totally nailed it. That's exactly what I thought.
Thank you, man. Thank you so much. Yeah, that was a conscious thing. You know, I mean, the tune is, you know, a simple set of chord changes. And, you know, gospel singers like Mahalia Jackson, Susan Tedeschi, because I know her and I know Derek, you know, I've been around them and I've heard her sing a lot. And I'm sure there was some things that, you know, in the back of my mind, you know, when I was playing that, I was, you know, drawing from, you know, my love of gospel singers and, you know, some of Susan singing and, you know, and the other great gospel singers that we like to listen to, kind of started, you know, just come popping up and, you know, the twang bar on the guitar really helps you kind of, you know, go to a more vocal place because it can kind of make the frets disappear, you know, and make you come off sounding more like a singer at times. And sometimes it'll make you sound more like a harp player or a slide guitar player. You know, Within You, Without You was done the same way. You know, it's just, but they all sound different. You know, the gospel tune sounds different than the Within You, Without You, which sounds different than the harmonica type thing. But it's all coming from the same place. It's the same guitar and it's the same amplifier. And, you know, but the music's different, so it's going to pull different things out of you, you know.
Well, let me ask you something totally different on the Red Wing Special.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's something that I really, really enjoyed, too, on this album. And to me, Jimmy, I don't know if you see it this way, but I kind of think of that Western swing as a sort of a mirror image of the blues in a way. Because
very much.
You know, it's like just as intense, but instead of being like that kind of raunchy, aggressive thing, it's sweet and happy. And
right.
I imagine it's got to be a blast to play. But as I listen to it, I'm thinking to myself, that is a whole different animal I was going to get at. That's got to be challenging as all get out to keep that swing going, because you have to know exactly where you're going and have it all, you know, sort of planned out, don't you?
Well, I mean, not totally. I mean, but yeah, you know, I mean, there's a set of chord changes that you're trying to, you know, you're spelling the chord changes with the improvisations. And, you know, when the chords change, you know, you have to change, just like in jazz, you know, it goes to a different scale, you know, whenever the chords change. And, and my goal is to be able to spell the chord changes with, you know, with the lines that you're playing during your improvisation. And, the chord progression is a basic blues with a turnaround, but it's coming more from a minor six blues as opposed to, you know, a dominant blues, that's what I normally, you know, more, you know, comfortable doing. But that little tune came into my head, and once I wrote the tune, I knew, I was like, oh man, I can't really improvise over this. I'm going to have to spend a lot of time, you know, shedding these chord changes and, you know, and approaching playing over these chord changes. And the idea is, you know, like, it's not a Dixieland tune or anything, but I don't know, some years ago I got really into Pete Fountain. Pete Fountain is a clarinet player in New Orleans, and mm-hmm. He might not be with us anymore. He might be gone now, but he's a brilliant clarinet player. And their approach to playing blues, in that type of blues that they do, it's not about the dominant seventh like it is in, you know, the kind of blues that I grew up learning and playing. It's more about the sixth than it is about the flat seven. And, you know, it's a whole nother kind of blues. And, you know, so I remember several years ago learning some of Pete Fountain's progressions and some of his lines, you know? and that's kind of where that tune actually came from, even a lot of people think type thing. And you know, I love Django.
Jimmy, we're breaking up a little bit.
But Pete Fountain, this brilliant clarinet player from New Orleans, you know, he had all these, you know, the way they have just my thing going. I wanted to write a tune using that kind of formula, so that's kind of where that tune came from, you know.
Yeah, and of course you got Nikki Sanders on that too. And,
yeah.
And then I thought, you know, that's a wild combination, a classically trained violinist who studied jazz, and now he's playing what he calls mountain jazz, and then you've got an African bass player playing Western swing like that. It's pretty wild.
Yeah, and we had Jeff playing brushes on that song.
Yeah, I wanted to mention that. That's beautiful.
Yeah, his drumming on that song is just, it's masterful, you know. He blew us all away, you know, and so, you know, we had different approaches with the song. Like, we tried just using like a normal swing, but, you know, I'll kind of thing, you know.
Jimmy, we're breaking up. Do you have a landline I can reach on?
Yeah, this is the landline.
Oh, this is the landline. Oh, it's kind of breaking up a little bit. Okay. Because I don't want to, you know, you say something important and I miss it. That's what I wanted to avoid.
Oh, okay. Well, let me see. Let me look at this phone and make sure that it's not dying. Hang on a second. Well, it appears to have a good charge.
Oh, okay. I can hear you fine now. It just it was fading out on you a little bit.
Sorry. But,
yeah, there was another musician on there that kind of caught my attention. I think he's a young cat, plays cello, named Carter Herring.
Yeah, that's him.
Where'd you find that guy?
He was in the basement, man. Yeah.
How about that? How'd that come about?
Well, you know, Carter is a very talented kid. You know, he started playing cello probably in like the sixth grade, you know, and he took to it real fast. And but to be honest with you, you know, he doesn't play the cello much anymore. And but, you know, on those songs that we had him on, you know, the Within You, Without You and Hope, like before we ever recorded the stuff, I talked to him about, man, one day we ought to record this and get you to play cello on it, you know. You know, but the truth is he kind of lost interest in playing the cello and started playing guitar, you know. And, you know, there was a lot of guitars laying around, and there's probably more guitars in the house than cellos, you know. And, you know, he got really into Cornell Dupree and, you know, Albert King, and he loves blues, and he loves R&B, and he loves James Brown, he loves funk, you know. And he started getting into that and started playing guitar all the time, and so he kind of put the cello down, but he picked it up again to do this recording, and then he put it down directly after the recording. I don't think in fact, the cello is still sitting in the dining room right by the front door. In other words, he brought it home from the recording session and it hasn't moved since then.
That's pretty wild.
But, you know, he does a real good job. I mean, you know, if he wanted to pursue the cello, he could have gone a long way with it, because he had a real natural gift with it from the time, you know, probably within just a couple of months of picking it up. He was already, you know, getting good tone and the things you look for. He has good time and he has good tone, and his vibrato was nice and almost right out of the gate. But he just sort of lost interest, because I think, you know, the cello was something he sort of associated with school,
right?
You know, because he started playing the cello, you know, as a member of the orchestra at school. And, you know, and I just think that, you know how it is if you're in a school orchestra. They have a real narrow view of music, you know. They have, you know, it's about classical music and that's it. And but we talk about this when he chose to play the cello. I said, no, look, don't get discouraged because of the narrow minds of some of the people that you're going to encounter. You know, they're going to try to tell you that, you know, jazz is inferior to classical. And I mean, not everybody, you know what I'm saying, man, you know,
right,
just
right.
Some people that you're going to encounter, like his teacher, like his conductor of the orchestra at school thought that he was so gifted, you know, and they thought he should be taking private lessons. So we got him started taking private lessons with a cello teacher. And the cello teacher was really great, but real narrow-minded, you know. And, they didn't want him listening to, you know, funk and R&B and blues. And they even went as far as to say something along the lines like, you've been listening to jazz and R&B, haven't you? And Carter would say, well, yeah, I listen to all music. You know, I listen to Stravinsky, too. You know, and then they were like, you need to stop listening to that other music. And it really bummed him out, and he quit. And, you know, he quit the private lessons. And, you know, he grew up around all these musicians who basically taught themselves how to play. And he wants to do it that way, too. Like, he won't let me, I don't teach him anything, man. He, you know, like, he's got the ear, you know, and if you've got the ear, you can teach yourself to play. It's just that simple. And
right.
And he's doing that. And, you know, people keep coming to me and that'll go hear him. You know, he's playing in town. He's doing a lot of gigs, but not on the cello, you know, on the guitar.
Right, right.
And people keep asking me, man, what did you show Carter? You know, you showed him that and you showed him this. And I'm like, let me tell you what, I didn't show him anything. I mean, I might have showed him a few chords and maybe one or two scale fingerings. And, you know, and then he learned from that and started teaching himself, you know. And the kid is really, he's playing his little butt off, you know. He's on his way, you know.
Yeah, that's
proud
great.
Of him.
And I wanted to mention, too, you know, Melissa, that your PR lady, mentioned to me that your daughter did the artwork because she was asking me if I wanted to have this as an MP3 or a CD. And I said, well, I really love the artwork like I did on Lifeboat, so try to get me the CD. And she said, well, you know, Jimmy's daughter did that. And I said, no, I didn't know that. That's wild.
Yeah, yeah, she did do that. That was just one of – she's a student at the Savannah College of Art and Design here
in
Atlanta.
Oh, yeah. I've seen that before. That's nice. A big
yeah.
old building.
Yeah, it's a really good school, and, you know, she's a senior this year, so she's almost out of there, but, you know, she's had gotten into abstract painting, and she had several pieces that that could have been, you know, it could have been the album cover, but she wanted it to be that one, and I said, okay, well, that one's great, I like that one, so let's use that, you know. But she's into a lot of different things. I mean, she's into portraits, you know, where you know, realism, where you draw a person, you know, and you draw every detail in their face, and she's very good at that. But she's also into abstract. So it's really it's kind of like it is around here musically, you know. She just loves anything related to art, whether it be abstract or, like, I guess it's like I love Ornette Coleman and I love, you know.
Paul Desmond or
sure yeah I love anything from Sun Ra, you know, to the most, you know, to Roy Buchanan, you know,
or
someone who is just, you know, Paul McCandless, or, you know, and it could be something totally in too, you know, it could, you know, it's a, you know, gospel music all the way to abstract jazz. It's all just great music, and that's the way she feels about art, you know.
That's great. All right, well, you can pass that on to her. I really liked it. I thought it was great.
Well, thanks. I'll definitely tell her you said so. She'll appreciate it.
I couldn't pick a favorite from this CD because it changes for me with my mood. But I tell you one that I think is just really wonderful. It's 12 Keys. And Matt is just fantastic. I have a totally new respect for him after listening to that.
Man, he's incredible. Matt is incredible. He really is.
Did he transcribe those parts? Because that's so intricate. Or else you did multiple takes, because it's just wildly intricate.
Well, you know, there's the head on the song. See, we were playing that as a sketch, you know, and we weren't really, I hadn't written a head for it yet. And we were just basically using it as a sketch to improvise on. And so we would play the chord progression and people would take solos over it. And, you know, but then when we got ready to record it, I knew I had to write a head for it. And so we recorded the song as a sketch. And then I went later and I sat with John Keane and I did three, takes on improvising over the progression, and then we narrowed down pieces of it, and you know, I ended up writing ahead based off of those three takes of improvisation, and I took what I liked from it and actually wrote ahead, and you know, and then I recorded that and sent it to Matt, and then Matt learned it note for note, and then he came back to the studio a couple days later and recorded his part, which is basically just playing the same thing I'm playing. He doubled it with me.
Right, right.
You know, so I wrote the head, and then he doubled it with me later, and then we took solos, you know, and his solo was totally his creation, you know. He just improvised through the progression.
I love that. So it's so light and airy, and it's just a beautiful, beautiful piece.
Thank you, man. Thank you so much.
Yeah, and of course I wanted to mention too, when we talked last year, I don't know what possessed me to ask you about all those chicken pickers and telemasters, but I thought that was kind of cool that we talked so much about that, and you shared so many of the people that you liked, and then all of a sudden I hear Curfew with you and Bella Black, and you're kind of paying tribute, you know, to all the things that you talked about.
And, yeah.
I thought that was a lot of fun. And man, his lines are just so inventive and so cool on that.
Oh, Bela Fleck, man. Yeah, he's in a class by himself. I mean, that guy's, he's taken the banjo completely into uncharted territory so many times. And really, if I had the opportunity, if he was free, I would have loved to have gotten him to play on a lot more. But I'll definitely be calling him back to play on some, not typical, bluegrass or country type music, because that guy can play anything, but when I called him, I said, look, I've got this little hillbilly jazz tune, it's like country tune, but it's got jazz harmony in it sometimes, it's sort of like, there are changes in it that you got to play, but it's definitely got a country attitude to it. And, I said, would you be interested? And he said, yeah, man, hell yeah, I'm interested, And I had to send him the file because he wasn't available to record with us at the same time we recorded. So I sent him the file. He was in another state somewhere on a tour, and he took a day off from he had a day off on tour, and he went to a studio wherever he was. I think he was in Vermont, And same thing had to happen with Bill Evans. And Nikki Sanders, because they couldn't actually be at the session, so they had to play their parts, in a different town and then send them back to me, which I hate that, but I'm also grateful that I, because if it weren't for that technology, I wouldn't have been able to play with those guys, so.
Well, too, Jimmy, what I thought about that is in a way it's kind of cool for you because you get the excitement and the surprise just like the fans, sort of. So, I mean, most of the things by heart, and you've heard it a million times when it comes out. But on those pieces, you get to hear it sort of for the first time, when you play it back.
So yeah, that's
true. That's kind of cool,
Yeah, man, it was cool because I had, the heads were written and, and the people's solo space was open and it was allotted for, and I knew the track was there, and it was just a matter of them learning the heads, and those guys are all such consummate pros,
But like when you hear what they do, and it just knocks you out. I mean, that's got to be great.
It is, definitely, man. It was wonderful. It was a great process. In the future, I hope we can do it again and actually be in the same room at the same time. But sometimes that's just not possible, but yeah, it was really great. We laughed so hard when Fleck, sent his track back to us and we listened to it for the first time.
Uh-huh.
We were all just on the floor laughing because it had so much personality, and his spirit is so playful and wonderful,
Yeah.
It was so much fun. He brought so much fun to the track,
Yeah, I love that. I thought that was so clever the way he did that.
Yeah, we did too. He knocked us all out, man. We loved it.
Yeah, well, I know you've probably been on the phone talking to people all day long, so I'm not going to keep you. But I wanted to say thanks a lot and congratulations again. And I wanted to let you know, Jimmy, this is something you can share with Carter. I sent you a DVD via Suvik. And Carter will love this because this is a great Austrian classical pianist who was one of the top Mozart interpreters of the 20th century.
Oh, and he will love that.
And he loved jazz. And like there was a concert in Salzburg, one of the big classical festivals, and he had Joe Zawinul come up on the stage with him, and they complained about it, and he just broke off his performance and wouldn't play. But on this DVD, did a straight-up Mozart piano recital, and then at the end, he pulls out this B3 player to this classical audience and does a couple of jazz tunes. So I thought you'd really get a kick out of that.
Oh, man, yeah, I can't wait to hear that.
So ask Suvik about it. He has it then.
Now, wait a minute, though, man. You just mentioned that Joe Zawinul came up on stage and people complained?
No. He wanted to bring Joe Zawinul up on stage with him at this classical thing because, he's like you. He didn't believe. He said music is music, And he said, this is bullshit, too, that I have to give like a program where I say exactly what I'm going to play. He said, you know, jazz musicians don't give a set list in advance. I'm not doing it. He wore street clothes on stage, and he was just an absolute bad boy. And he'll just knock you out when you see it.
Oh, man, that's incredible.
And it was really cool because this just came out, this DVD. It was from the 1991, I think it came out. It was recorded originally, but the DVD just came out. You know, he did the same kind of thing with Chick Corea and with Herbie Hancock here and filled great big Philharmonic halls in Europe, you know, with duet concerts. They're on, like, YouTube, and you can get them on Amazon, too. They're great.
Oh, I'm sure, man. Incredible.
So you're going to love this, I think.
Oh, man, thank you for sending me that. I can't wait to hear that.
Okay, Jimmy. Well, thanks so much for this CD. I love it.
Well, thank you so much, man. Thank you.
Okay. Take care.
All right. You take care. Good talking with you.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye.
So, a short postscript. As I listened to that, I realized that I forgot to mention the name of the Austrian pianist. That was Friedrich Gulda, G-U-L-D-A. Like I said to Jimmy, you can go to YouTube or to Amazon and find videos up from Gulda. They're just great. And it was kind of fortuitous because the month before I spoke with Jimmy, I had just interviewed Barbara Dennerlein. She was the B3 player that I mentioned who came up on stage during that DVD performance. And in the interview with her, I got her to speak about Gulda, and he was a very, very fascinating guy. Be sure to check that out. You can go to the interview on talkingtomusicians.com. And the way YouTube is set up, there's a playlist. So the interview is in 5 parts. And instead of hitting the play button, there's a skip button next to it. So just hit the skip button and you'll skip through the various parts. And when you get to part 5, you'll see it's labeled Friedrich Gulda. Also, I wanted to mention, I made it sound like Friedrich Gulda broke off his concert in the middle when Joe Zawinul came on stage. That's not the way it happened. What actually happened is he had planned to have Joe Zawinul join him on stage as a guest as part of his concert performance. And the classical promoters didn't like the idea, so Gulda just refused to take part in the festival. And that's what happened. Okay, till next time then.